Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening.
Everything politics. 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 I wanna know what's going on in the White House. I wanna know what's going on in the nice house. I wanna know what's going on in the government. I wanna know what's going on in the trouble mess. I wanna know what's going on with the politics. I wanna know what's going on with the politics. I wanna know what's going on with my health care. I wanna know what's going on with this health scare. Everything politics. 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 Everything politics.
Welcome to tonight's edition of Everything Politics. I'm Dennis Speed, and as we say each week, you shall know the truth, and the truth will set you free. We have a lot of things to discuss tonight. I want to thank people for the comments that they've been making about the show and some suggestions as to what we can do. Obviously, this is our show number 3, and we're just on our maiden voyage, essentially, in these next last couple of weeks. And so we are going to tighten things up, make sure that everybody is involved in the act and that it's clear what we're doing week to week. Now, this is called Everything Politics, and therefore there are many different things we can talk about. But what we're going to do from week to week is to have a lead opening topic and make sure that you know what that is and what we're going to be going into, and then that way your questions can be directed as you see fit. Let me therefore say that tonight what I want to do is do two things. I want to talk first of all about something that nobody is talking about, and that is the date of September 30th, the month of October, the first 15 days of October, and the possibility of a full-scale economic meltdown becoming manifest once again, despite the fact that everybody is telling you that there is a recovery. And so let me say why this topic is important, why this is happening. What is happening on the September 30th is that that is the end of what is called the fiscal year. It means that all of the budgets for the United States have to basically converge, all of the balance of payments, the trade deficits, all of that have to be reconciled as of September 30th. September 30th is the end of what is sometimes called the fiscal year, but it's also the end of other economic and financial cycles. Now, what has been happening is that the reason that they are telling you that that the system looks better than it has looked, and that there seems to be a recovery, is actually that they have decided that most of the actual debt that was out there is unpayable. And a little bit later in the show, I know someone had called and wanted to know where we were getting some of the figures we were using. We'll refer you to the particular AP wire that we had at that particular time, indicating that the debt is $24 trillion, and that what has happened basically is that there's been a decision made they're not even going to try to pay it. The reason they cannot try to pay that is banks don't have the money and the government does not have the money. and what will begin to occur as a result of this, starting as of October 1st, you'll begin to see that the government is going to have to start to cut back on all kinds of essential social services. Just as an example, take unemployment insurance. You'll begin to see a crisis in unemployment insurance. It won't happen on the 1st or the 2nd or 3rd of October, but it will happen after the 1st of October. You begin to see crises in state budgets. Of course, as you probably know, 49 of 50 states already say that they are bankrupt. And what's going to happen is that the federal government will begin to make cuts, further cuts, in those budgets. That's just going to happen. Nothing is going to actually stop that. And so when we're saying everything politics, when we started this show, one of the reasons we started this show was that some time ago, about a year ago, in the course of a discussion that I was having with other people on other radio shows and other radio stations, I referred to Lyndon LaRouche, the economist and statesman, and what he had done in July of 2007 when he told everybody in advance of it happening exactly what was going to happen. He told everybody that what was going to happen was that the system itself had collapsed. This was July of 2007. And when they talk about July of 2007 and tell you what they tell you about that, they tell you there was a subprime mortgage crisis. They tell you that what happened was that some people who should not have gotten loans got loans, and that that was the cause of the actual collapse. That did not occur. No such thing occurred. What actually happened on July 25th through 28th of the year 2007, that the entire financial system blew out, not the subprime mortgage system, everything blew out. And from that time, what everything means is the credit default swaps, the derivatives market, all of the actual debt, the real casino game, the one that they are still hiding from people, which is not the $1 billion of the bailout, not the $24 trillion that they accrued in debt between last September and now. It's $1 to $2 quadrillion, which has never been admitted to and is the actual reason why you will never repeat, never pay the actual debt that's out there. And so when you start talking about health care, or you start talking about unemployment insurance, or you start talking about the bankruptcy of cities, all of these things, or the mortgage market, whatever you name, the actual topic is that as of July of 2007, the entire system blew out. And there is no way to actually put it back together. That system will never come back together. And what we've been living in is we've been basically sort of like the Roadrunner and Wallace Coyote, the old Roadrunner cartoons. You've ever seen those where he goes running off the cliff and he's still running even though there's no cliff underneath him. That has been our situation ever since July of 2007. And so what is playing out in what you can call the body politic, in what you are reading about, in what you're being told about, in the different parts you hear about, whether it's Afghanistan or whether it is healthcare or whatever they are talking about, these are all shadows of the real substance. The real substance is there is a complete breakdown of the present financial system. You cannot bail it out. You must create a new one. And the problem is the only way that can happen is the presidency of the United States is the only means in the entire world to put that system back together. Now, why is that? The presidency of the United States is a unique world institution. It is not just because it's powerful, but it's powerful because the Constitution of the United States allows for the president, together with the Congress, the executive and legislative branches, can under the authority of the Constitution, protect the general welfare of the citizens. And they are allowed to do whatever is required to do that. And that includes creating a credit system. It's different than a finance system, but a credit system in which you use the national wealth of the people of the United States to put the country back to work, to keep local banks functioning, to preserve the basic welfare of the people, to stop people from starving, to allow them to get adequate health care and the other things you need. But you are running something which is not your regular budget, but not a regular fiscal budget, but it's called a capital budget. The reason these terms are important is because nobody will tell you that this is the power of the presidency. And the current occupant of the office has failed to deploy those powers on behalf of the American people yet. Now, some people get very upset about the issue of criticism of Barack Obama, but there's a problem. Barack Obama, as president, is failing, and he's failing consistently, largely because he has a group of real characters, real nut jobs, as advisors that he must remove in favor of competent advice. And one of the people he would have to listen to, it would seem, is the person that knew that the system was coming down before the system came down. You will look in every newspaper, every magazine, New Yorker, Vanity Fair, you name them, and all those people say all of the time, nobody knew what was happening. Well, actually, various people know that that is not only untrue, but the people saying it know they are lying because it was known and it was available, and it was the economist Lyndon LaRouche who specifically laid out in July of 2007, way before the bailout and way before the collapse of the so-called subprime mortgage market, way before that, that this was happening and that it had occurred, and what they have been doing is trying to cover up for that fact. So that's just the way of starting us off. Now, one thing I want to also say to you about how we're going to run this show, we will take up topics and try to give explanations or to make sure things are revealed that are otherwise not revealed. Now, let's just take something that's been going on around healthcare. You know, people often ask us, how do you know what you know about, how this healthcare policy, which is a Nazi policy, and it's a policy that was not something that Obama came up with. This is something that was handed to Barack Obama, not even when he came into the White House, before he got to the White House. Because what had happened was that his advisors, and we're going to name some names here and give you some things to refer to, you can go to, and you can look these things up. His advisors had already been discussing this with people in London, which is where this policy comes from. And I want to be very specific about how this happened. Now, Barack Obama has someone that heads up his office for management and budget, and his name is Peter Orszag. Peter Orszag, during June 3, 2008, he spoke in London. At that time, he was director of the Congressional Budget Office, and he was speaking at a forum being held in London. Check this out, in London, on U.S. healthcare. So he gave a presentation which was called Healthcare, Capturing the Opportunity in the Core Fiscal Challenge Facing the United States. Now, this is before we have the blowout of the subprime mortgages. He's saying, because the United States is undergoing an economic crisis, we can use this to reduce Medicare. I want to repeat that. Reduction of Medicare is what Peter Orszag, who's presently at Office of Management and Budget, that's what he's dedicated to. Now, but who's he working with? There's an individual by the name of Simon Stevens. This is an important name for you to know, because who Simon Stevens if he is the person who was the medical advisor, actually the health minister for Tony Blair, Prime Minister of England, who then came to the United States. He became the head of a thing called United Healthcare. That's one of the largest private HMOs in the world. It's headquartered in Minnesota. It operates in 45 countries. It's 70 million people. Now, I want to tell you about Simon Stevens. This person formed a thing called the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. This is a British organization, National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence. It's called NICE. Now, that organization, together with a medical organization, a hospice actually, called the Marie Curie Hospice in London, started a policy and promoted a policy of what is called involuntary euthanasia. Let me break that down for you. That means if you go to the hospital and you're in there and they determine that you are near death in their way of thinking, they simply put you under deep sedation, deny you liquids and food, and you die. Now, an article appeared on September 2nd, 2009, in the London Telegraph. The title of the article was Sentenced to Death on the National Health System. And here's the subtitle. Patients with terminal illnesses are being made to prematurely die. An NHS scheme to help end their lives, leading doctors have warned. So the article goes on. This was in the London Daily Telegraph. It's talking about the National Health System of London. It's written by Kate Devon. It came out on the 2nd of September, 2009. So look it up. It's there. What they say in this article is one out of every six people that have died in the United Kingdom, basically between 2007 and 2008, died from involuntary euthanasia. In other words, they were killed. They also go on to say that they actually had the National Health Service had what they call a national strategy report. This report had provisions that instructed you how to falsify the death certificates so you could say that the patient died from natural causes rather than the fact that you killed them. Now this is not a joke. This is not something that I am just making up. Look for the London Telegraph, sentenced to death on the national health system, Kate Devon, the medical correspondent, 2nd of September 2009. There's another article called Dying Patients from the 3rd of September, subtext, a group of experts who care for the terminally ill claim that some patients are being wrongly judged as close to death. Now, why Simon Stevens is important is he went from London, came over to the United States, headed up what's called United Healthcare, and now is in charge of what is called their United Healthcare Reform Program. Now, what this program is now doing, as we speak, he is advisor. It's called the United Health for Health Reform and Modernization. They just wrote a report for the United States government called Federal Health Care Cost Containment. How in practice can it be done? What he is recommending to Barack Obama, and remember, this is the person in charge of 70 million people worldwide, they are recommending cuts of $500 billion in Medicare. Now understand what I'm telling you. This is a British national who used to be the health minister in London under Tony Blair, back in the 1990s, early to 2000, 2001 period, got out of there when Blair went out of power. He left, came to America, became head of one of the biggest HMOs in America, has written this proposal and is out organizing for this, and he is one of the major influences on the advisors, Peter Orszag, Ezekiel Emanuel, and all these people. So this plan is not Barack Obama's plan. This was made and approved in London, and it is about killing people and cost-cutting by cutting lives. Now, I'm sorry, that is the truth. So if you know the truth will make you free. What can we do about this? what needs to happen is all these people just need to be dumped. It's not a thing about playing around and seeing if you can change how they think. Just dump them in the policy. And that is the kind of public service we intend to do with our show. So we've taken this question up. We're going to take up other questions like it. That's why when people talk about death panels, they're telling the truth. That's why they're talking about the right thing when they bring this up. And as I said, you can look it up. There are various details, various organizations. If you need more details, call in at 914-338-1941, 914-338-1941. We're going to take a break now. We'll be back after these messages.
You are listening to Everything Politics with Mr. Dennis Speed right here on WBCNRadio.com.
Everything Politics. 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 Everything Politics.
Make sure you join us over at WBCNRadio.com or WBCNTV.com and become a member. It's absolutely free. And you can download these podcasts right after the show, 15 minutes, over at iTunes.com. Select podcast and download the show. That way you can take Everything Politics with you on the go. You are listening to Everything Politics right here on WBCN Radio, New York. And we'll be right back after this short break.
You are listening to WBCN Radio, Bashani Communications Network, worldwide.
Roll with the motivator. Roll with the motivator. Roll with the motivator. Roll with the motivator. Roll with the motivator.
Make sure you check out my new show, Roll with the Motivator, only on YouTube.com. Just search Roll with the Motivator. Or for nonstop action, you can join us at BennyRandall.com. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. And don't meet me there. I want you to beat me there so you can roll with the motivator.
Hey, what's up, ladies? Oh, my bad. I thought y'all was hooking.
It's not like if we were, you could afford us anyway.
If we were, you couldn't afford us.
Miss Jackson wants to see you in her office right now.
If I get one call about you, you are fired.
You are firing me? Mom!
Don't mommy me.
How many hands you think untouch these boxes before we get them?
I'm liking that.
You want America to steal something?
How you gonna get fired, man?
I wish they would. I'd be on Lion King crying. It's terrible discrimination.
I'm gonna need you to sign.
You get anything today?
Nope.
You sure?
Yep.
What is this?
Carmen 303.
What's across the hall?
I know this ain't what I think it is.
It is, yeah! Am I dreaming it?
I know who we can sell it to.
Bingo.
Boom.
Now I put $150,000 in your pocket today.
I'm man.
I need to count that money.
It's crazy.
Hello?
You got it, right?
What? It ain't come here. The delivery dude, he stole it.
We're gonna need more of these.
Oh, that's not gonna work.
Yeah. Ay, Dios mío.
Yo, that's him right there. All the way.
I'm gonna take that
pen. It's not me.
Turn around.
Oh, you said all the way.
Can I say one thing?
What?
I like your outfit. You look very nice.
10 people.
My bad. Get thanks.
24 hours.
Good morning.
That's what I'm saying.
Only one way to survive.
School's out. Recess is over.
Think inside the box.
Yo, what's up?
I dropped a box off here. It's the wrong address. So do you have it?
Well, we did have it.
next day air.
Everything politics. 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 Everything politics.
You are listening to Everything Politics right here on WBCNRadio.com or WBCNTV.com. Make sure you become a member and join us for absolutely free at WBCNRadio.com. Put up your profile and you can interact with all your favorite shows right here on WBCNRadio. And now you can download on iTunes. Just select podcast and hit WBCN Radio. And you'll be part of the great and expounding and powerful family of WBCN. And now we return back to Everything Politics with Mr. Dennis Speed right here on WBCNRadio.com. Enjoy.
Okay, welcome back. So again, the number to give to call in is 914-338-1941, 914-338-1941. I have a couple of matters of business to take care of here. We had a caller that wanted to know, it was about a week ago, where some of the statistics came from that we were using. So I just want to refer to a press release, Associated Press. This was from July 20th of 2009, this year. Financial bailouts cost to U.S. could total $24 trillion. And then it goes on to say this. I'll just quote it. The federal government has devoted $4.7 trillion to help the financial sector through its crisis, a watchdog report said Monday. Current circumstances, the report said, the government's maximum exposure could total nearly $24 trillion, or $80,000 for every American. Now, the reason for the difference in the figures is, they say here that much of the government's assistance is backed by collateral, and that there is an estimate of $23.7 trillion once you put together the amount that they just gave out, which is the money that you know about from the bailout, for example, plus loan guarantees and other things they provided. But when you take the collateral that was put up to guarantee the $4.7 trillion, the total exposure is $24 trillion. So $80,000 for every American, man, woman, and child. That is, as I said, an Associated Press release. You can look it up. It's called Financial Bailouts Cost to the United States Could Total $24 Trillion, July 20th, 2009. All right, that's the first order of business. Just want to get that out. As I said, you can look that up. Now, there was a second concern that was voiced. This one had to do about with the fact that the president, Barack Obama, had extended the state of emergency that was called by Bush at the time of 9/11. And someone wanted to know whether this was true. So what we did was we got the press release put out by the White House, and I will simply read you that press release, not the absolutely entirety of it, but most of the press release. And you can get this by just going to the White House site. This is from September 10th, 2009. And this is what that press release said to the Congress of the United States. Section 202D, National Emergencies Act, provides for the automatic termination of a national emergency unless, pursuant to the anniversary date of its declaration, the president publishes in the Federal Register and transmits to the Congress a notice stating that the emergency is to continue, in effect, beyond the anniversary date. Consistent with this provision, I have sent This is Barack Obama saying this. I have sent to the Federal Register the endorsed notice, the enclosed notice, stating that the emergency is to continue in effect beyond the anniversary date. Consistent with this provision, I have sent to the Federal Register the enclosed notice stating that the emergency declared with respect to the terrorist attacks on the United States of September 11th, 2001, is to continue in effect for an additional year. The terrorist threat that led to the declaration of September 14th, 2001, of a national emergency continues. For this reason, I have determined that it is necessary to continue in effect after September 14th, 2009, the national emergency with respect to the terrorist threat, signed Barack Obama. So just so nobody is confused, this is the president. It is his press release. He is saying he is continuing the Bush-Cheney policy on the declaration of a state of emergency. All right, so that's the other item I just wanted to get out there, because the question was it true? Did he do it? Were people just saying that or what? Of course, there are tremendous implications of that, because that is what they used. Of course, that state of emergency, you can almost call it a state of siege. And the question you have to ask yourself is, why would that be continued? And who was it that advised that it be continued? Is this simply Obama himself? That's a possibility. Is it Obama plus advisors? That's also a possibility. So that is the second matter, so that people are just clear that that happened. And then finally, somebody brought this to my attention and wanted to comment on it. This was another Associated Press release, and it is from today. And it talks about how one of the advisors for Obama, former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker, is criticizing the Obama administration for maintaining what he calls a plan to bail out those too big to fail. Now, let me just clarify so people understand who Paul Volcker is. He was the head of the economic of the Economic Recovery Advisory Board. So he is technically a member of the administration right now. And so he headed up the Federal Reserve from 1979 to 1987. What he's saying here is that if you are going to bail out banks, that's one thing. But if you're going to bail out AIG, which is not a bank, or for that matter, if you're going to bail out investment houses, as he calls them, you cannot do that. That the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is supposed to be the means by which the citizens are protected, because they put their money in the bank, and the money in the bank is supposed to be protected by the FDIC, unlike during the time of the Great Depression from 1929 to 1933, before Franklin Roosevelt came into power. What happened was, if you had your money in the bank, you lost it. And what happened was that when Roosevelt came in on March 4th, 1933, as President of the United States, he declared a bank holiday, and in the course of the ensuing week or 2 weeks, he basically introduced the idea of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. And so the problem, as you may know, this was not in this press release, is that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has run out of money, which would technically mean, so everybody is clear, those are the people that insure your money in the bank. So I just said, and I'll repeat it, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation has basically had to bail out over 80 banks this year, and they now no longer have the funds to do that. Now, there are two ways that you could handle this. One would be they would get more money from the government itself, but what has been proposed is that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation should get money from banks. Now what they're saying is they should get money from the banks that did that were given the bailout money, the big banks like Citicorp, or Citigroup rather, or Bank of America, some of these, J.P. Morgan Chase. But the problem with that is those banks are still bankrupt. They don't say that. Nobody wants to say that out loud, but that's the case. So how can the FDIC go to banks that themselves are in trouble and get money from those banks to bail out other banks? You know, that's pretty wild proposal, and that's exactly what they are proposing. Now there's got to be a scam somewhere there, you probably are saying, and you'd be right. Because what the scam would be would go like this. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation would go to J.P. Morgan or Bank of America, and they would say, please loan us some of your non-existent funds, and we will pay you from the taxpayers of the United States to loan us your non-existent funds, which funds we had to give to you in a bailout that is still ongoing. Now, see, you may say, wait a minute, that can't be really true. I mean, that's got to be illegal. That's got to be something that you can put people in jail for. And you would be right, except that nobody is putting anybody in jail. Because this is a question of political power. And this is why we come back to the idea everything's politics. Again, 914-338-1941, 914-338-1941, for whatever questions you may have. And you can also join us in the chat room. You can also Twitter, Facebook. You can hit us on all the different levels because the mighty Benny Randall has set that up for us. So, that's what we have to say about that. So what I just want to point out, just in this final thing is, let's take a break right now. We're gonna ask for more questions. See if we have something further to say. That people have as questions or comments. So we take a break and we'll be back after these messages.
You are listening to WBCN Radio, Bashani Communications Network Worldwide. Roll with the motivator. 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 Make sure you check out my new show, Roll with the Motivator, only on YouTube.com. Just search Roll with the Motivator. Or for nonstop action, you can join us at BennyRandall.com. Sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. And don't meet me there. I want you to beat me there so you can roll with the motivator.
Everything politics. 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 Everything politics.
You are listening to Everything Politics on WBCN Radio, New York. Make sure you be part of the solution instead of part of the problem. Call in at 914-338-1941. That's 914-338-1941. Or you can Twitter us at twitter.com/WBCNTV. Or become one of our members over at WBCN Radio, New York, where you can be part of a powerful people with powerful ideas creating powerful relationships. You are listening to Mr. Dennis Spieth on Everything Politics right here on WBCN Radio, New York. And now we return back to Mr. Spieth on Everything Politics, WBCN Radio, New York.
Okay, we're back. I want to just point out also, people were asking about the question of how is it that the federal government could even address any element of this problem if it's bankrupt. In other words, if you're saying that the government is itself out of money, then how does a bankrupt government help the people? Very good question. Let's go back to a time before in this country where that actually happened, because this happened back in the 1930s. In other words, we have been through this depression. It started in September, October of 1929. And what happened was that people were radically unemployed. They were rapidly losing their farms. Remember, about half of the population of the United States at that time lived on farms. And therefore, there seemed to be no recourse because the banks failed, the businesses failed, nobody had any money, and people had lost their livelihood. So the question was, how could you get the economy rolling again if there was no credit and there was nobody who had the apparent means to deal with the problem because the problem was so big? What happened at that time is a little bit different than what is going to happen this time, but in principle, it's the same thing. At that time, what happened was that the elected president, Franklin Roosevelt, who came in after the Depression had been going on for over 3 years, he acted right from out of the starting gate. And what he did was he said, all right, we've got to go to the American people and first of all make it clear to them there's nothing to fear but fear itself, what he called nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror, which paralyzes needed efforts to convert retreat to advance. Now, at the time, people just thought that was poetic, but what he was talking about was he was going to try various measures. He didn't exactly know what was going to actually work, but the important thing was to use the sovereign powers of the U.S. government. And those sovereign powers of the U.S. government were given to the president through the Constitution. Now, what did that allow him to do? It allowed him to use the powers of government to jumpstart the whole economy. And he started these large-scale projects. These are sometimes called infrastructure projects. Now, let's take today and let's give a comparison as to what kind of thing you could do. If you look at the bridges of this country, the water system of this country, where you can't even get clean water out of a tap any longer. You look at the roads, the highways, you look at the power system of the country. Now, all of these things are what is called infrastructure. Also, things that maintain your workforce, for example, like your hospital system, are also part of your infrastructure. And then things that educate your workforce are also part of what's called infrastructure. If you take the United States today and you were to put a price tag on how much you need to do to either overhaul the infrastructure or maintain the infrastructure right now, if you did that, then you would come up with approximately an $8 to $9 trillion price tag on infrastructure needs just for the United States. But remember, we are no longer in an economy which is just limited to the United States or even a region. You've got this so-called globalized economy, which is generally speaking a very bad thing, but it is globalized. So that you're often eating, if you eat meat, lamb chops from New Zealand, and you're buying oranges that don't come from Florida, but they come from Mexico, and so forth and so on. And, of course, all your clothes are not made in this country more or less any longer and so forth. So what you have is a situation where if you look at the infrastructure needs of other countries combined with the United States, and there are many of these. Let me give you an example. You take Ethiopia. You take the problem of famine in Ethiopia. Is the problem that they can't grow enough food? No. In fact, in the western part of the country, they have plenty of food, but they don't have refrigeration, and they don't have a rail system capable of effecting transport of the food before it spoils. You find this in many other nations, particularly in Africa, which could actually be the breadbasket for the entire world nearly. It could not only feed itself, but it can feed most of Asia and Africa if you needed to feed Asia, which actually Asia has a lot of very good agricultural land as well. But the point I'm trying to make is that you have a globalized infrastructure deficit, and everybody needs it. So you have a situation in which you could match, let's say, the infrastructure needs of America, Russia, India, and China. I take those four because those are continental nations. The United States spans the Atlantic to the Pacific. You look at India, that's sometimes called the Indian subcontinent. You look at Russia, that's 11 time zones. And then you look at China, which is 1.4 billion people. If you start looking at the power needs, the water needs, the transportation needs, the hospital needs, medical needs, and the educational needs of those places, I guarantee you, you will come up with a price tag which will allow all those nations to take their respective workforces and through government action initiate policies and programs that could put the whole world back to work. Now, that's a very important idea. Now, some people, and this is what happened to Roosevelt, try to say that was socialism. But the reason it's not, and it can't be, is because you have to think about the idea that when you actually go to implement these policies, you need to have small groups of people, private individual firms, contract for these things. Because, you know, countries, when you start talking about really building up a rail system or a highway system, these are very particular projects that happen in particular localities. And the localities have geographic limits. They have all sorts of specifications. And you have to be able to employ people that know what they're doing. And what you're doing with the government is you are jump-starting the project. You don't want to hold on to the projects because you have other projects that you have to initiate. And so it's to benefit of a government, as it turned out to be in the case of the United States in the 1930s, to jump start such projects. And so this is the way that you do this. Now, some people, the second question that comes up is, where's the money come from? How do you monetize this? Well, the point here that's important to understand is people don't eat money. They may burn money, but you can't wear money. You can't eat it. You can't, you know, write with it. Money is actually secondary or tertiary in an economy. And the brainwashing that's gone on among our people has been, that money is what an economy is. Money is not. Money is a vehicle in an economy to allow you to get some physical production, a real physical change to happen. And so this is what you basically have to have. And so the concept is that what you do with the powers of the Constitution of the United States is you set a standard. You set a precedent like we did back at the time of Franklin Roosevelt. Now, the United States doesn't have what it had back in those days in industry and all that kind of thing. It doesn't have that. That's true. But what it does have is it has a constitution and it has a crisis. And those two things give you enough power to take the capacities of the federal government and use them for the people. Let's just take what we talked about in the previous segment when we said from the AP Wire that $24 trillion in debt was all of a sudden assigned to America from September of last year. Well, wait a minute. That means that you clearly can take $24 trillion or less, in this case it would be less, and you could assign that to jump-starting the real physical economy. I mean, in other words, if you're putting real people to work, which is what we have not been doing, and those real people are actually benefiting, those real people are taking a real salary in. They are producing real products that are going to be bought and sold by real nations. They are generating real wealth, and that real wealth takes its form in money because money allows you to trade among those different countries and to move goods and services appropriately. What you have to do with your banking system in this situation is you got to get rid of these massive mega banks, multinational banks. Got to shut that down. You actually should not even have banks which are more than state banks. You should make banks operate in, a New York bank should operate in New York State. A Minnesota bank should operate in Minnesota. a California bank should operate in California. And the wealth that you are generating from that population, the tax money, for example, that goes into, or the revenue, the salary, I should say, that goes into the bank, these things, the state taxes, for example, they should stay in the state to build up the wealth of that state. So you should not have international banking of the type that we have, or cross interstate banking, let's put it that way, interstate banking. Because obviously the issue is, and you may say, well, how do you break up the banks? That's simple. They're already broken up. These things are already bankrupt. You see there's no more Lehman Brothers. There's no more Bear Stearns. Yeah, they were investment banks, but they're gone. And the others that should be gone are all those banks that were trading in these derivatives and this other speculation. We should not bail out any of it. We should completely separate ourselves from all of it. And this is really where we have to take ourselves. That's the wave of the future. Again, 914-338-1941 if you want to call in. I think I've probably dealt with basically the issues that got raised that people wanted to know. I hope that that answered that question that we were getting about how you actually pay for this process. What I would just say is what you can help us do, those of you who want to know, is that you can go on the web and you can find different explanations. A part of this, you can go to, if you go to, for example, LaRouchePack.com, which is Linda LaRouche's site, or LaRouchePub.com, which has a lot of the actual background research that was done by Lyndon LaRouche and his organization. You can check that out. And there's other sites that you can go to as well, which we can cite. Now, I just got a question sent to me. Michelle wants to know why the White House does not have people like you, Mr. Speed. All right, so here's why that is. You have to understand that we can't blame everything on President Obama, but we can blame some things on him. See, he was set up because people knew there was a weakness. They knew that Obama has a tremendous ego. And as somebody said to me, if you're black and you're running for president, it's hard not to. I can understand that, but there's a problem that we have right now. That ego has run way out ahead of his circumstances. You know, in other words, Obama's like a guy who, has found himself in the position of being the top pilot on the space shuttle, except he's only flown, you know, small aircraft. Now, when you're in that situation, you have a crew. And the crew is going to have a lot of people in there who are going to be competent. Now, you also may have some people in there that are trying to mess you up. But the issue involved is that you have to know, you've got to select a competent crew to go up with you in that space shuttle, because you are going to run into circumstances. Most famously, we know about, for example, Apollo 13. You know about some of these other circumstances, like the blowing up of the shuttle in 1986. You can run into circumstances where you can literally destroy the ship of state in the case of the presidency of the United States, whether you intend to do that or you don't. And you cannot allow yourself to be sidetracked by the fact that there are some people that may wish you ill, and you don't, therefore, out of your own ego sense of things, you just say, well, I'm not going to listen. You can't do that. What has happened with respect to the Obama administration has happened with the other administrations in the case of the presidency. But the problem is that the time is different. And so here's what I'd just like to say specifically about that particular question in terms of how to think about that. Because there are many people are competent in the United States. Now, some good people, for example, right now in the State Department, you notice that Obama has not said he's going into Afghanistan with more troops. That's very important because it looked like that was going to be said at one point. There was a talk about 17,000 more troops and so forth, and all of a sudden that dropped out. And even though the military advisors are saying, send more troops, Obama's not saying that. Now, that is because there are people who are advising him correctly that the worst thing you could do is to commit more troops to Afghanistan. The worst thing you could do is do that. You need to pull out of Afghanistan, and the reason that does not threaten you is because the thing you want to do with Afghanistan, where nobody has ever won a war in all of history. No one has ever successfully occupied Afghanistan. So what you want to do in that situation is pull back, let the people there tell you what they need, and deal with the interdiction of the financial transactions that are going on around the opium trade. You know, that's where all the opium today is coming from. Helmand province, southern Afghanistan, now spread into the northern part of the country. It is the British intelligence services that are running a lot of that opium, but it's mainly their financial services working with their intelligence services. Now, Obama does not want to take that on because the British are the people that have been trying to control his administration. That's exactly what has to be done. And so there are some people that are working with the administration that are doing a good job. Certainly, what Mr. Obama could do is call upon people like Lyndon LaRouche in the same way he's got Paul Volcker there as an economic advisor. You got a man that actually forecasts the crisis. So you don't have to explain why you have to talk to him. So I would just say to Michelle that, listen, the point is there are many different people who are available and who are competent. But the problem is we, the people, have got to give the president a message, which is forget trying to go along with this crowd, the British crowd or any other crowd. Don't go along with these people. Break from these people. Break before it's too late, because these people make me you no good. And so I think that is the way that people need to think about that. We're coming up on the last few minutes of our show, so what I'd like to just say to people about next week. See, we want to take up a topic next week, which a lot of people have been asking about and many people are unclear about. And sometimes it has a term called the unitary executive. It all it refers to is what are the powers of the president? What can he do and what can't he do? What's good about what he does? What's bad about what he does? How extensive should the powers of the president be? Because on the one hand, you seem to be saying the president should just do all these things. But on the other hand, you're saying, well, but the president's doing all the things wrong. So how do you know? What are the checks and balances? What roles does the Congress play? And this is something that needs to be taken up because, as I told you in the past segment, that the president has renewed the state of emergency that the Bush administration was holding. And let me just put it this way. Is that really necessary? I don't think so. I think that's a step down a slippery slope, which should be reversed. You don't need to do that. But then the question is, what should the presidency be? What is it composed of? How could the president actually lead us out of an economic and financial crisis? What gives him the right to do that? Is he outside of his bounds as a and then in the case of the Obama administration, most importantly, here's a case where the president needs to basically clean out almost the entire set of advisors. And is he capable of looking beyond his ego to do that? See, that's a serious question. And these are serious matters that we have to take up. So next week, the topic's going to be the unitary executive. What should the Obama presidency do to return the United States to the constitutional form of government it had before 9/11? All right, so we're pretty much out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. I want to thank the people who had the questions and the comments, and we'll see you next week. And remember, everything politics tells you, you should know the truth, and the truth will make you free. See you next week.
Everything politics. Everything politics. Everything politics. Everything politics. Everything politics. Politics. Everything politics. Everything politics. I wanna know what's going on in the White House. I wanna know what's going on in the nice house. I wanna know what's going on in the government. I wanna know what's going on in the trouble mess. I wanna know what's going on with the politics. I wanna know what's going on with the politics. I wanna know what's going on with my health care. I wanna know what's going on with this health scare. Everything politics. Politics. Everything politics. Everything. politics. Everything politics. Everything politics. Everything politics.
Listening to WBCN Radio, Bashani Communications Network, worldwide. You are listening to WBCN Radio, Bashani Communications Network, worldwide. Next up on WBCN Radio New York is Mr. Speaker's Spotlight. You can learn more about Vincent T. Edwards at blessenterprise.com. And make sure you visit us at WBCNTV.com. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to the August 2009 edition of Mr. Speaker's Spotlight. I'm your host, Vincent T. Edwards, better known as Mr. Speaker. My guest, the spotlight will shine this month on Ms. Altamise Barnes. She is the founder and executive director of the Riley Center and Museum. But before we get started with this interview, just like to let you know that this edition of the Spotlight is brought to you by J-Centric, the key to your recording and entertainment needs. They do everything from audio restoration, CD duplication, live recording, studio recording. They are your key to recording and entertainment needs. That's J-Centric. You can reach them at area code 850-385-6309. That's 850-385-6309. Call them for a detailed quote or rate. That's right, J-Centric, the key to your recording and entertainment needs. My guest today is Ms. Altamise Barnes. She holds a master's degree from Florida A&M University. She is the founder and executive director of the Riley Center Museum. I mean, the honors and awards go on. I mean, her resume is truly extensive. Honors include Lincoln Teacher of the Year, Tallahassee Urban League Community Service Award, Frontiers International Community Service Award, City of Tallahassee Volunteer of the Year nominee, City of Tallahassee Historic Preservation Award, Outstanding Regional Sigma of the Year, Capital Outlook Unsung Hero. I mean, the accolades go on and on. Ms. Barnes, welcome to the Spotlight.
It's a pleasure to be here.
First and foremost, for my listening audience, I'd like for you to give them an overview of who you are and what you represent.
Who am I? Okay, I am a longtime Tallahassee resident, one of a few that's still here. I think now we've sort of narrowed it down to we have about 22% native Tallahasseans, and I think that has really been an attribute, an asset, in keeping with what I do. As you stated, I did graduate from Florida A&M University, and of course my major is nowhere near what I am about now. I graduated in music. I was a piano major, voice, and then went on to guidance and counseling, worked with Department of Labor, and was a civil rights investigator for many years. And when I decided to retire from the Department of State, had already involved myself in some volunteer historic preservation initiatives, sort of brought into that by one of our renowned educators who passed away a few years ago, Miss Aquilina Howell. Mrs. Howell got me involved in the Greenwood Cemetery Restoration Project and membership on the Florida Heritage Board. And so following her around, I developed this love, this appreciation more of an appreciation, I would say, for preserving history. And so that's what got me to where I am now. And it's been a very fruitful journey. It's been a very satisfying journey as far as being able to help both young people and adults.
When you look back at your extensive career and where you are now, from an inspirational, motivational standpoint, who stands out in your life, the person that pushed you, motivated you to succeed and to be ultimately successful?
You know, Vincent, I always have to go to my parents, because my parents, given the odds, accomplished way more than people now with a lot of education, a lot of money. My parents came from very humble beginnings. My father grew up on Wilani Plantation within a tenant farm family. And my mother was born and grew up on the McClay Plantation out Meridian Road. Now, my mother's parents were not sharecroppers or tenant farmers, but her father was the caregiver, the overseer, caretaker of the property. So my mother was a 10th grade graduate. There were 12 in her family. Her mom died when she was in her 40s. Being the oldest girl, my mother had to drop out of school to take care of the other children.